la 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 la. All right. Hey, I'm Chelsea Manning, and this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Regarded as holy, don't hold me when is dying, and I am afraid of the dark, blue and the white. Badges and pistols rejoice in the night. And we watch the news, and we see him die tonight, tonight, his baby said goodbye. Roses in a row, teddy bear outside, bullet down the right. But it's love when you need it. Too many babies and suits.
This is WCBN FM, and you've got the Living Writers Show. I'm Amanda Yulee. I'm your guest host today. We're pre-taping on December 5th, 2018, and our guest is Nana Kwame Ajabrenya. Welcome, Nana.
Thank you for having me.
So glad you're here. I'm going to read a short bio from the inside flap of your new book out this fall, Friday Black. It's a collection of short stories. I'll read it, and then we'll hear a little bit more from you.
Copy.
Nana Kwame Ajabrenya is from Spring Valley, New York. He graduated from SUNY Albany and went on to receive his MFA from Syracuse University. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in numerous publications, including Esquire, Guernica, Compose, a journal of simply good writing, Printer's Row, Gravel, and the Breakwater Review, where he was selected by ZZ Packer as the winner of the second annual Breakwater Fiction Contest. Friday Black is his first book. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, and congratulations on all the attention and success the book is receiving.
Yeah, it's we've been very lucky. It's just been amazing. You know, we've got my first book, and to be received this way, I feels like a blessing. So I'm happy about it.
Yeah, it's such a powerful book. So well deserved.
Thank you.
For our listeners who may not have picked it up yet, it's just out. It's out in October of 2018. I wonder if you could kind of introduce the book for us. Just tell us all about it.
Yeah. So Friday Black. It's a collection of short stories that is not exactly bound by a particular genre or even, you know, or realism or a particular mode. I think a lot of people have sort of gravitated towards the more surrealist aspects. Some stories are pretty dystopian. Some stories are set in the future. Some stories are set in almost like a alternate time space. But I think what sort of is more consistent about the book is that almost all of them, if not all of them, are concerned with the different ways people dehumanize each other, the different ways people sort of convince themselves into kind of stepping on each other's heads. Earlier, when I was like trying to figure out a way to, you know, give people like sort of the elevator pitch about the book, which is hard because they are pretty disparate story to story, what I finally arrived at was this book is sort of like if you imagine three people sitting on a couch, and the first is like, wow, you know, this feels really good. I like the feel of this. You know, I'm happy we have it. And the other person, the second is like, yeah, I also think this is a great couch, you know, great lumbar support, great butt feel.
You
know? and then the third is sort of like, I also think this couch is pretty comfortable, but I think we're overlooking the fact that it's made out of corpses. I think this book is sort of like that.
Yeah, it's takes a dark and surprising turn at moments, like that analogy. So how do people react when you describe the book that way? People agree?
I think they, you know, I think, and I guess similar to the book, I say it like that, you know, sort of straight with like without much inflection on the fact of that there's corpses. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes people a second to sort of, huh? And then they kind of laugh, and then they can like, huh, you know, which is, mm-hmm. again, like, kind of the thing I'm looking for. You know, maybe a laugh and wait, then hold on, wait, maybe actually, wait, hold on. Is that funny? You know?
Yeah. Am I allowed to laugh at that? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you feel about people laughing at this book? I mean, I'm getting right into it here, but
yeah.
There's a lot of humor, but this topic.
I want them to.
You want them to. Tell us about that.
I don't think that laughter equals, insignificance. You know, yeah. I think that you can laugh at the absurdity of something. And I think if you do, and you tailor that your sort of craft, right, you'll laugh at how obviously terrible things you just accepted previously were. You know, so I think the laughter is a sign of engagement, and engagement is key for me. As a writer, as a teacher, I think if you don't get them engaged, they're not going to, it doesn't matter how educated you are, it doesn't matter how knowledgeable you are about the thing. I think getting them to laugh is key, but then also like getting them to stop laughing too. And so, you know, sometimes you set up a joke and the punchline is actually, this isn't funny. So, mm-hmm. For me, humor is my way into the room, my way into people's sort of hearts, I guess. And once you have them, once you reel them in through the humor, then you can do whatever you need.
So are you finding that people respond maybe first, or people who might be uncomfortable thinking about race in America or thinking about some of the more violent or darker or mm-hmm. difficult topics in your book? Are you finding that readers are hitting on that humor piece first as like a way in to those conversations?
I suspect they are in their reading experience. I think by the time they get to report back in a way that I can hear, they're more focused on the actual issues, actually. You know,
yeah.
Sometimes they don't talk about humor at all. But when I'm actually, like, when I speak to people at length, they eventually do get to the humor, which is cool, because I think, like, on the way out of the book, they're more, you know, sort of meditating on the seriousness of a lot of the issues that kind of get brought up. And also just the experience of these characters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they do say it's weird because it was funny. And so, again, I think funny is a way in, but once you get them in, now you can really do something.
Kind of demonstrates the importance and ultimately the enjoyment and satisfaction in facing and tackling and, you know, confronting those issues instead of being afraid of them.
Yeah, and it is scary, you know. And again, it's not even like I attempt. Let me talk about race here. Let me talk about capitalism.
Right.
Let me talk about whatever it might be. But you know, you do write about these issues that are difficult. Your characters are in very difficult situations, and it isn't always easy at all. It's usually very difficult. But for me, writing is already difficult, and so it feels like if I have the chance to say something, I want to say something that matters.
Yeah.
People often, the number one question often actually is I get is like some version of like, why do you write these political stories? Why so political or whatever?
Uh-huh.
And my response at this point is kind of like, I don't know what you would prefer me to write. You know, I don't know what I should be saying instead. And if the house is on fire, I don't want to talk about what's in the fridge, you know?
Yeah. It's a lot like the corpse analogy that you just made. It's true. Yeah. Writers should write what's in their hearts.
Right.
So maybe it would be helpful for me to know more about kind of how the book came to be. When did you start these stories? And what was the publishing process like?
So I started these as an undergraduate at SUNY Albany, the oldest stories, I guess. And I right when I was get, as I was getting ready to get into the MFA at Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time, I think, earlier on in Syracuse trying to figure out what kind of writer I might be and sort of doing bad Dennis Johnson, bad Toni Morrison, bad Juno Diaz, bad whoever.
Uh-huh.
As I think is part of a lot of people's process and figuring out who they are. And eventually I sort of got to me, you know, after digging through a lot of other people. And I got to me, I was like, no, this can't be right. Let me go back to doing bad this person. You know, I was resisting trying to be funny. I was resisting being sort of, outside of reality exactly. I, for sort of arbitrary, quote unquote, literary reasons, I think. But eventually, luckily, I got out of that, you know, by working with people like Arthur Flowers and Dana Spiota. I was able to sort of feel encouraged and doing my own thing. And then finally, George Saunders was my thesis advisor. And, you know, I remember very specifically trying to get him to tell me, be this kind of writer, that kind of writer. Because I had this kind of cachet of surreal-ish stories and these other stories that were more based in realism. And I was, I remember being like, you know, trying to get him to tell me, should I be this? Should I be that? Should I write these kind of stories, George? Should I write that kind of story?
What a great person to ask, to turn to. Should I be a surrealist or not?
And he was sort of just like, yes, you know. and he also even told me, like, even, you know, even a ghost story is a realism story. He kind of erased the distinction in my mind. And that's what I try to tell people now. You know, you write a story, you have to make the world, even if the world is the one you know and people know, or if it's a world that is not. And so for me, that is, it's really just about how can I get my characters in situations that are just as powerful as possible? How can I make the story surprise me? How can I make this something that is vital? And it's less about, is this in the future or not?
Right. Something you said a minute ago about kind of being encouraged and encouraged to be yourself made me think about the conversation we started, you and I started right before our program began, about encouraging young writers in communities, which you're starting to do in your hometown, it sounds like.
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's, I try to be just very, very intentional about this meaning, like, all this writing stuff, and now that I am sort of not on the outside looking in anymore, what can I do to make someone else feel that they're welcome in this very homogenous world, this world that has for a long time pretty actively excluded them and their stories. So I'm from a place called Spring Valley, Rockin' County, and that's on the back of my book. It's the first line of my bio, and I say that very specific. That's very intentional. Mm-hmm. I think people from where I'm from often, like, they'll sort of get out, quote unquote, of Spring Valley, and now all of a sudden, like, they're from Brooklyn, you know,
or
because we're very close to the city. And I was born in Queens. I was born in Corona. I lived in Lefrak City, so Lefrak City buildings. But I'm from Spring Valley, and I like to claim that very proudly. And even that is like a small piece of me sort of starting to try to encourage these kids that they can do anything they want to do. I'm often invited back to do like speaking engagements now, and I try to make them know, like, you know, they are just as valid and just as seen, just as worthy of anything and everything as anybody else is. I'm really interested in just pushing whatever I can towards them. And because I think that reading is essential, just to being a critical participant in the world, and even having opportunities generally, I'm trying to push like some literacy stuff. And so I'm just in the beginning, and I haven't done what I want to do yet. You know, I'm still like kind of like recuperating after my first tour.
Many cities. You were in Michigan, but I looked at your tour. Yeah, that was...
It was intense.
looked exhausting.
Yeah, and it was my first time doing that, but now that I'm starting to get a little bit of time to chill a little bit, I'm interested in learning from the people who are already in this. I very briefly met Kwame Alexander. I'm going to follow up with him about how people like Jason Reynolds, people who get kids excited about reading, people who speak to the experience that is familiar to the people from where I'm from. And so people like Elizabeth Acevedo, I'm really interested in getting them in that area to show these people, like, look at this, like, look at what you could do, and just get them excited about the idea of being a person that reads. So figuring that out, being a person that writes, seeing how I can use my person and my sort of momentum in that way is like a big, that's what I'm into right now, you know?
Yeah, it's a really good thing to be into, if you ask me, because I'm into it too, as I mentioned. One of the things I loved about picking up your book and reading in the very first page, the dedication, I'm just going to read you back the dedication for my mom, who said, "How can you be bored? How many books have you written?" which is, it speaks so much to the notion of encouraging young people and you know, people who haven't spent time writing yet, but who could and who need to be welcomed. So I wondered if you wanted to say anything more about that.
Yeah, and I mean, and that, you know, that quote, I think it reads a little more nicely than it really exists. You know, that was kind of like getting my mom when I was calling at me, like, "How can you be bored?" You know, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, get away from me! Like, don't come here with that. But I am lucky though, because they my parents did value reading and education a lot. You know, they both have more than one degree, and you know, they're the kind of parents where, like, they drop you off in the library when it opens and pick you up when it closes. And now that I teach as well, I just feel like there's so much power in getting students to believe in their own creativity. That's what, and I, as I said, like, just earlier today, like, I'm really, really into the project of, like, 826 type programs, and getting kids just to feel that they are already experts of something. That is, like, they can translate something just as well as anybody, and it's themselves. You know, they have the ability to translate themselves onto the page and share that with people, and that's, like, a kind of magic. And getting, and that's, it's a great magic, because for me, and part of why I even came to reading, is, like, it's free and no one can take it from you, sort of. And that's why I sort of, I think, fell in love with writing. And I like 826 programs, because I think they sort of help teach kids to learn that magic early and find, and that's such a powerful thing. So it's important for me.
Yeah, it's absolutely a powerful thing to give young people that idea that they can do it. And then you're right, it doesn't go away. It doesn't take much money or anything else. It really just takes a little confidence to get people going. So I think we're going to do a short song break, and then we'll come back. We are talking today to Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, who's author of Friday Black, a collection of short stories out this year. And we'll have a song, and then we'll come back and talk more to Nana.
You are watching a master at work.
And we're back. It's WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is the Living Writer Show. I'm Amanda Yulee, hosting today. Our wonderful engineer at the board is Frank Yulee. And we're speaking to Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, who's author of Friday Black. Thanks for being here, Nana.
I'm super happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a fun conversation. I love talking about your stunning new book and the stories in it. I want to, you know, we talked before the break a little bit. We started talking about realism. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned erasing the distinction between realism and surrealism and some of the kind of hyper-real moments in the book. I would love to kind of get into that conversation a little bit more. I mean, I found myself reading this book. You kind of go along, you're a paragraph or two or a page or two in, and things are very real and modern and seem like they're exactly as happened in the real world. And then there's sudden and surprising and kind of extreme shattering violence or weirdness. And I think it made me question how the world is changing and how we might have already begun to accept some things that are just wrong and very shattering, but they're becoming, yeah. they're blending into that realism. And that was my read on it. So I'd love for you to speak about that, that notion right. of realism.
Yeah, for me, it's like, I mean, like for one thing, I think for sure we definitely have just culturally accepted so many things that I don't think should exist, like in any sense, you know.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, so many things, and even things that maybe don't seem as far off as the obvious, like perpetual random murder that's everywhere around us. You know, even just the institution of prison as it exists now, like, what does that should that be a thing? But you know, for example, but for me, the thing with the realism question is like because I think about it from a character sort of focused place, I want a situation for a character to be in because they, you know, it has arrived to me in whatever way. And maybe the situation requires something that doesn't exist in this world, but so I make it, right? Mm-hmm. And now I want that person though to respond in a way that is honest, but also potentially surprising and interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's true. The same way, if I have a story that takes place right in the regular world, that is, you have characters moving through spaces, and you want them to sort of, they're bumping up against their environments in different ways, and the different things that their environment produces. And sometimes I've created that environment and tailored it to a very specific place that only exists in my imagination, and sometimes I've tailored it to something that's very reminiscent of Lowe's Home Improvement where I worked. but I, you know, I'm still creating, you know, from like sort of my sort of imaginative mind. And I'm still, again, trying to find avenues through which purposeful arrivals can happen. So if I have a kid in the future where everyone has to take some kind of mood stabilizer, mood improver thing. Okay, cool. Is that a thing? That's not a thing, but I want that to be the case because I want the world to be so messed up that everyone requires that. So I create industrial good, which is like in the story, like the era. And then I kind of get an idea of what that world is. And then I have this character move through that world. And again, in a way that makes sense, but also could potentially be surprising. Maybe there could be some swerves, as Dana Spiota says. And I follow the character through the space. And so for me, that's what matters. Like, how is this character moving? How is this character potentially changing? What is the occasion of the story? What are the stakes of the story? Those things are what matter to me. And again, like, whether it's going to be labeled sci-fi or dystopian or whatever, you know, those are tools I have in my bag to, like, make points and, like, to sort of emphasize and also create humor and just establish engagement. I think there's something pleasurable about trusting a reader to discover a world with you, you know, sort of as like the fog lifts. Oh, look, we're in the future. And the reader kind of says, like, you know, I get that. I understand what you're doing here. I think there's some fun and pleasure in that. And so, you know, it's those are cool and that's important. But also I think you write stories that make people feel. And you write, and for me, I do that. I try to do that through having characters that are purposeful and real, quote unquote, and moving through a space honestly.
Right, right. Yeah, I have to say, having read the book, I didn't come away thinking it was sci-fi or thinking about those things, even though I saw some of those kind of intense things happening. I mean, for me, it felt like you were taking a very real world and some of its darkest, most violent parts and kind of cranking up the volume on those bits and really helping us consider how close our current reality might be to something scarier.
Right. And I think for sure that is sort of the process of it. But for me, like in that cranking up the volume, sometimes, you know, some people read that as whatever genre. I also didn't really think of it. I hardly think of genre at all, you know, because I think it's mostly a selling tool. But I think that also goes as far go matters regarding literary, quote unquote, literary fiction as well.
Yeah.
Because I think literary fiction just means how boring can you be and still be good, you know?
Your book's not boring, Nana.
You know, I think sometimes like people who write quote unquote literary fiction aim almost to have like nothing happen. Yeah. It's like plot is bad or something. And I just think it's all weird, received, I don't know, prejudices against different types of modes of telling stories. You have all this ability. You're making things up, and the only thing that's valid is making things up that look exactly like the world that already exists. It just seems so. This feels like a failure of imagination to me. Not to endeavor in that way, but to feel that way is in any hierarchical way better than any other mode. And again, it's to me, it's mostly an illusion. And I think my book, I'm happy that I was able to break out of that, because I think the one of the strengths of my book is from story to story. You can see that, you know, this, you can do this, you can do that, you can do anything.
Yeah. Do you, when you're creating these worlds, and I loved how you brought it back to being character focused, because I think that's, again, how it really read for me, is that these characters in your book have their motivations and their goals and their hearts and their humanity at the forefront. But still, they're in these worlds that, to me, reflected in many ways current events and the news, but again, with the volume cranked up. How much are you doing that consciously? Do you see a news story that's horrible and hard to believe, and do you write about it? Like, is that...
Very, very rarely. Like, actually, probably none. Uh-huh. Well, actually, you know what? That's not true. Well, I feel like some news stories sort of sit on my back like a boulder, uh-huh. You know? I've been thinking about Trayvon Martin since he was murdered when I was in college, you know?
Yeah.
And so some of them, yeah, I don't think I'm going to write a story about it, but it's like a thing that I can't not see it.
Yeah.
Very rarely do I hear any particular story and then like meet like one-to-one, try to do a try to write something in response. But that's not to say I have an idea for something that I do think is pretty heavily influenced by, like, I don't know her name, but that girl who like loves guns so much, she's taking pictures with her like AK-47 everywhere.
I don't know about this.
She's like really into like open carry, and it's like, she's like the NRA's new mascot, sort of. Or they're using her that way, it seems.
Okay.
And I have an idea about, like, if the world that I feel like she's arguing for existed, what would that look like, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes, but it's never, like, direct mm-hmm. pull.
It's interesting that you brought up Trayvon Martin, because when I read the first story in the book, I just felt there were many echoes of that story. And it made me consider that true story in a few new ways.
Yeah, and sometimes I do explicitly allude, like, his name is George Wilson, like the killer, his name is George Wilson Dunn, which is an amalgamation of George Zimmerman, is his name, Officer Wilson, and is it Michael Dunn, like a bunch of different white men.
It felt that way, I felt like it was a reflection in a way that was important, you know, important to help us remember. That happened many years ago now, and it's hard to believe how little has changed since then.
Right.
Do you want to talk about that story, the Finkelstein Five, a little bit?
It's the first story in my book, pretty purposefully. I think my thinking was, if people read one story of mine and nothing else, I would prefer it to be that story.
Hmm.
I also think that it's a pretty intense story, and I think it's sort of a risk to start off that way, because I think it's the most intense story probably in the book. And but it's kind of like, if you can ride this ride, you can like handle this, you know, this thing.
Yeah.
So I think that's why it makes sense. For me it was really important, because it marked a place for me that kind of taught me what I'm looking for in a story when I'm writing, or a feeling that I'm looking for. And that is to say, so really quickly, when I was in college, like I said, I was in college when Trayvon Martin was murdered. And me and one of my friends in response sort of like secretly and anonymously made these like pamphlets. And, you know, we put them out and we printed out 500 copies because I think that's how much I could afford to print it. And we like threw them around the campus, scattered them. And so people would read it. You know, we went to bed feeling very full of ourselves, like, you know, we solved racism today. Let's go to bed. And, you know, obviously the morning racism was not fixed.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought this was going to be a people or a conversation or something, and nothing happened, actually. And actually, you know, that morning, I actually saw a janitor throwing them some of the pamphlets out. You know, we were pretty much just littered. And I didn't like that feeling. But in writing the Field Scene 5, I had a similar feeling in, like, that is, I wanted the story to exist in the world, even if my name wasn't attached, you know? I thought, like, if I had written this anonymously, I would still want to scatter that story out. And now, that's sort of the feeling I look for in writing fiction. And so that story has to do with a young person who can adjust his blackness on a scale of from 1 to 10. And he has to do that to move through the world. And he also having to do that while considering these 5 young black people who were recently killed via chainsaw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a powerful story. And I have to say, one kind of moment as a reader that I've gone back to in the book is what you do next, which is, and again, for those who haven't read it, I don't know how many pages the Finkelstein 5 is. 15 or something. And then that story ends, that intensity ends. And then you have a story that's about a page and a half.
Yeah.
And it is quiet and it is sincere. The other one's sincere too. But it is not violent. It is sad and thoughtful. And it's called Things My Mother Said. Totally different character. So, like, I would love for you to speak to... And maybe we need a song break and then you can come back and speak to this longer point. But I would love for you to speak to how you put those things together. I just opened the book. It's 26 pages. So on page 26, the Finkelstein 5 ends with a bang. And then you have this transition.
Mm-hmm. I'm very considerate about the order of the stories. And like that's very important for me. Like, you know, because it is so intense, let's give them something a little calmer.
Uh-huh.
But also, you know, if that's the first thing I want everyone to read, the second thing would probably be like, you know, I Love You, Mom, as just about as unadorned as that. I mean, still a lot of craft stuff that goes into making a story that feels like it's unadorned. But like, you know, really like real life, this is like me saying this to you. And then, you know, after that, one of my favorite transitions in the book is, you know, that story ends. I hope you can be proud of me. And maybe I'll read from that story, actually. And then the very next story starts, Suck One and Die. So I like that sort of, you know, brief interlude, then back to the regularly scheduled program.
Yes, that's exactly. It feels a little like TV. And on that note, let's have a song. Let's have a break. We're talking on the Living Writers Show today to Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, author of Friday Black. We're going to have a short break, and then we'll come back. I would love to have you read, so think about what you'd like to share, and we'll be back in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Now I was dreaming about a deal at the age of 13. I was fiending for the meals, I ain't talking Burger King. Some of my niggas in the field, all they did was surfing. Skills, I had skills all day rehearsing. The pretty boys had them girls, spent their time flirting. All they wanted was some waves like they could surfing. Hold up, now don't get it twisted, I ain't hating, do your thing. I was like a young Simba, couldn't wait to be the king. Now there's the prince. Hopped over the fence where the grass way greener. Look at Shawty, way meaner. Something like Serena mixed with Trina, have you seen her? She fine enough to be Miss Howard, word to Adina. My money like a senior, watch it graduate. Now it's time to eat, I'm letting all my grab a plate. Grab a take the rear, stay away from phony.
And we're back with the Living Writers Show on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, hosting today with our guest, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. Nana, do you want to read a selection from Friday Black?
Yes.
For us? Great.
And just because we set it up, I'll actually read the story, Things My Mother Said, and it's short enough that I can read the whole thing.
Okay.
Things My Mother Said. My mother's favorite thing to say to me was, I am not your friend. She'd often say, you are my firstborn son, my only son, as a reminder not to die. She loved saying, as a way to keep me humble, I didn't have a mother. You're lucky. You have a mother. When the TV went dark, my mother said, good, now you can read more. Then our house at the bottom of a hill lost all its life. Gas, water, electric. One day I came home to the warm smell of chicken and rice. I hadn't been able to steal a second burger in the cafeteria at school that day. My stomach whined. At home, the fridge had become a casket bearing nothing. The range and oven had become decorations meant to make a dying box look like a home. Hunger colored those days. Where's this from? I asked, already carving out a healthy portion from a worn gray pot. My mother pretended she didn't hear me. She was studying the pages of her massive white Bible at the kitchen table. Wide sheets of light pressed through the window and draped her. She spent her days reading that big Bible. Its pages were to film as her fingers fluttered from psalm to psalm. She'd be asleep by the splash of dusk. I, on the other hand, would be up for hours, trying to do homework by the blue glow of my cell phone, clinging to its light until it died. At night, hunger and I huddled together. I'd fall asleep thinking, one day I would change everything. That afternoon, I ate the chicken and rice. It tasted like pepper and smoke. How did you make this, Mom? I asked again. She looked up from her Bible. Allah, dear, did you pray over your food? Did you say your psalms today? I ate the food quickly, greedily. I chewed the bones till they splintered in my mouth. Another thing my mother often said, you are the best thing that ever happened to me. Later, when I was in the backyard, hesitant to return to the dying box as the sun dipped away, I found a patch of charred grass and a small circle of blackened stones and pebbles. An ash moon branded into a sea of wild green grass. I touched a gray rock, partially blackened by flame, to see if it was still hot. I felt proud and ashamed. For the record, I know I was lucky. I know I am lucky. I don't think you're stupid. I know I am not your friend. I hope you can be proud of me. That's that story.
So beautiful. As a reader, again, transitioning from the story before it, which is not in first person, like that one is. And this one, it sort of made me consider the voice and the character. I mean, it makes me wonder whether you feel like you yourself are the character in that second story, the narrator, or whether someone else. Okay.
For me? Like, am I? Oh, yeah, yes. For sure. That story, definitely.
It's autobiographical in some way. Yeah. It reads that way. But also, I questioned it because, the transition with that, with the story before it and the story after it.
And for me, that first three story sequence is like really like, to me, I think of it as like the intro to me is like a, in the world as a writer, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and for me, it's like, again, doing that, the, not just only realism and not, but also, I guess, heavily inflected with stuff and just also me just saying kind of, you know, this is just it for real. Like, this is just me. And I think especially ending on that, you know, sort of moving to the second person, I had a lot of that sort of could be very jarring, you know, story-wise maybe or something. And I just totally was more than willing to accept that for that kind of, for me, like starting off in the beginning and we're like, you know, I want this on the record kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. It's a vulnerable moment in the book for sure.
Yeah.
I'd like
just
to
real quick. So, you know, that's why, you know, be vulnerable for a page and a half.
Just a moment. Then, yeah, just a moment. And then it goes back to something.
They're that kind of vulnerable.
It's something different. I'd like to talk about, if you would, the notion of America and Americans in the book, which struck me over and over. And, you know, there are concepts in the book that I think are distinctly American and unfortunate, related to racism, related to capitalism. And you know, to, in some respects, to assimilation and immigration. I'd love for you to speak to that and how much that kind of was a conscious part of what you were trying to do with the book. And how, and also, like, how you think the book plays, if it already has, but does it play to other audiences, you know, foreign audiences?
I think it does, because America, you know, it's just such a global, the world is gets smaller in so many ways, you know, and a lot of the problems of America are the problems that the world has. But yeah. I was, like I said, I was born in Queens. I spent most of my life within, like, probably 300 miles of where I was born. I'm from New York, and I've been in New York. And I've just recently got to see more of America, but America is what I know, you know. I think, and for me, there is a lot of, but also because I was raised by people who were statistically, were not born here, I think, and because they very explicitly kind of tell me, like, about, don't think you're allowed to do this. I'm not American, so don't think that's going to be okay here. It's just their parenting style or whatever. I think that maybe trained me to sort of look at what might be like particular to America, maybe. But again, I'm not even sure that that's true, but maybe it just trained me to think about what it is that is sort of standard and why. And so I think America, because of its wealth, you know, values a very particular material wealth, because that's kind of its thing. You know, look how rich we are. That's like, in a particular way, it's like, we very explicitly sort of tie virtue to having money. And which is weird, because we also very explicitly sort of have culturally, in a way that should be present but are not at all, I guess, like advice about how money is the root of all evil. You know, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle, than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. You know, that's explicit. That's like, you know, that's from the book, you know. But a lot of supposed Christians, you know, and even, you know, yeah, you have to value wealth a lot to allow someone like Donald Trump to be president, you know, just like a lot, you know. So I think that's a very important sickness to us, the way we sort of not only value wealth, but really feel as though capitalism will, like, sort of separate the good from the bad through who will end up having things. And I think we know very, very explicitly that's not the case. So that feels like very American to me. And that sort of ties, I guess, to the general notion of being okay for whatever reason, mostly because of, I think, our comfort with people dying everywhere around us. You know, people who are, there's rich people. And it's like, to, you know, like, how ethical is it to be a rich person in a world like this? You know, to me, not very. But, I think America, like, prides itself on, like, you know, look how many billionaires we have, look at all these things we have. And again, it's like, it seems so directly contrary to sort of the project that is presented. And I think that's a particularly interesting thing to me. That is, you know, the whole give me your poor thing, but then actually we don't care about the poor. The whole, look how important we are, look how much we value immigration and our diversity. Because it's explicitly, sort of in the project of America, the people who were here indigenously are treated poorly, and the people, and so it was, we're taken of a land, quote unquote, built by immigrants, and then look how we treat our immigrants. You know, again, that sort of direct contrast, like what seems to be the whole project, is especially interesting to me. Sidebar: I was watching the show called it's like Final Table on Netflix. It's like Chef's Table, but that show about this cooking, but it's like a contest.
Okay,
and they did a whole thing about America, you know, like the way it's structured, they go from country to country. You have to, the cuisine of Japan. These judges will choose like a the best, like, you know, make, you have to make some signature dish that's associated with Japan. The same thing with France and Italy and whatever. They finally got to America. And, you know, the host is all about, like, America's strength comes from its diversity, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, cool, you know, yeah, that's supposedly their thing. And then the judges come out, and it's three of them, and then surprise, surprise, there's three white men, you know. and then a fourth judge came for, like, the final part, and it was another white guy. And it was just, to me, I was like, that's about right.
Yeah, it's contradictory.
Yeah.
American really. Messages are extremely contradictory to what we see. Yeah. And then how does, I guess part of what I'm asking here about America and about your book is how you think consumerism and kind of retail culture, which shows up a lot in your book in different ways, in some, I think, beautiful and funny and elegant ways, but how that and racism connect.
Yeah.
Maybe you could make some of those connections for our listeners.
I think that whenever you subscribe to a system to that allows things to be valued over people, you're subscribing to all of those systems that do that. I think in American consumerism, and I use the Friday Black, the Black Friday thing, because I did work several Black Fridays in the mall, and I've seen how people, like, how easily people sort of choose a jean jacket over another human being.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that hard to trace. I mean, again, it might seem like hyperbole, but I don't think it's that hard to trace that from the literal buying and selling of human beings. You know, I think once you feel free, comfortable assigning values to things that seems to any to things that ever is above humans, once humans are not the paramount thing, once this other person is not right on top of the way you consider, the way you even conceive of your world, all these other things are all these horrors are going to be, once that's the paradigm, anything's on the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, that's connected to the free assigning and unassigning of freedom, which is, again, in the way we have prison, and then the privatization of prisons. And it seems, how could that be? But that, like, how couldn't that be? Look how we think about things. Look how we, and again, and look at who's in the private prison, the ones we already don't value, you know? So to me, this super fetishization of things and material and purchasing and the way we assign value, that isn't humanistic at its core, is connected to all these sort of egregious atrocities, the way our insurance system is, all these things that we have, you know. And for me, it's the easily observable sort of, I don't know, almost low level version is the one that I've been most exposed to. That is the retail culture in the mall. But it also exposes itself pretty clearly on days like Black Friday.
Yeah. Well, you've created a powerful and really enjoyable book that kind of addresses all those ideas. Thank you for doing that. The book is Friday Black. We're speaking to Nana Kwame Ajabrenya. This is the Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I think we have time for one more short song break, and we're going to do that and then get back to close out the show with Nana Kwame Ajabrenya. Thanks.
I'm a pretty dark person. I've thought about ending it a million times, and I have to say the music keeps me here. By far the main thing.
Thank you.
Sitting in the studio thinking about which move would go right now. Freestyle or write down, whatever. It's still a come up clever. I just need to free my thoughts, and Lord knows that I know better. But I ain't perfect, I ain't seen too many churches. I know them testament verses. You should either hear me now or go deaf, or end up dead, die trying and no death. Might end up dead, swallow blood, swallow my breath. Funeral, just make sure you pay my music respect. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. You see my art is all I have, and victory tastes sweet. Even when the enemy can throw salt, still knock them out the park like a f***ing tow car. Let bygones be bygones, but where I'm from, we buy guns and more guns to give to the young. I'm living the life of a trapped inside the system. All you envision is trapped. My uncle doing life inside prison. He wasn't rap too tight. He told me rap about life, not rap. That's why I'm shaking my...
And we're back on the Living Writer Show. Thanks for being here, Nana Kwame Ajabrenya.
Thank you.
So I think we could have spent the whole hour talking code switching, but I think we're going to only have a few minutes to talk about that now. And, you know, I wonder if you specifically would be able to speak to that aspect of the book that relates not just to code switching, but to clothing. Because I just kept coming up with, I mean, in the story we talked about before in the Finkelstein Five, it talked about the young people's clothing and what they were wearing and how that might, you know, very absurdly convey their guilt in something. And of course, there's some great moments with jackets, winter jackets in near the end of the book. But I saw clothing coming up a lot. And I wonder if that, I wonder if you could talk about that and how it relates to how we see each other.
And I was just talking about some of this, and I think I may write about it more. So I did work in the, I worked in clothing retail for a long time. The only real job I've had outside of being a professor at schools has been that. And I also know from personal experience the way, especially when you're young, like clothing, like what you have, what you wear decides who you are in terms of like your sort of social capital in any school space. But I think the clothing thing is interesting is because it's sort of a universal prejudice that we're all down for, you know, like you have to wear, kind of wear this thing. Why? Do you like it? No, just everyone is, you know, what's the utility? And I say this as I'm wearing a tie right now. Sometimes I like to do that. But why?
You're wearing a tie for a radio interview? That's good. That's great.
No, I have, we have an event. George is reading today, this whole thing. But like, is it about like, what's the utility of it? It's to show that it's, I guess, mostly like signaling, I guess, a status or something probably. But because some people can't afford to get that, who are you keeping out by this? Again, you can see that it's not that hard to trace the intersection between all these other sort of disadvantages that might be sort of just cares. Oh, they can't buy ties. Well, they don't deserve a job. It's like, and it has nothing to do with my ability to work at all. In any way, it's about my ability to adhere to arbitrary standards that were decided by people that were not me and probably didn't look like me. And actually, probably explicitly didn't want me in that space. And so, you know, I think you could argue that most of what we consider professionalism is just coded racism. It leads to sexism as well and all these things. But clothes, your ability to sort of jump through the hoops of this, whatever the space you're in, sort of determines your ability to move through that space effectively in ways that is not about usually your actual quality of what you're trying to do. And so it's interesting to me because it's just generally accepted. And if I decided I wanted to wear a clown suit for the next week, like I have a, like, I'm like, that's like, I'm like insane now, you know? because again, what's even more insidious about it is like, The markers move consistently, and you just have to be aware by paying attention to everyone else. It's like you have to, like, this herd mentality thing. Because I remember very well when it was like very cool to wear 3X. I think I'm gonna write an essay called "Where Did All My 3Xs Go?" I remember when it was cool to wear 3Xs shirt. I don't remember ever having a mental, like, the thought, I'm not wearing those anymore, but I don't have anymore. You know. Like, what happened there? You know, same thing. Oh, people wear bell bottoms. Now we don't. Now it's weird to wear bell bottoms.
Yeah.
You know, these same people are still alive. You just have to stay in lockstep with the herd or else, you know? And so, again, it's an easy one. Also, these are things you have to buy. So just, it's like the economy sort of like to maintain itself and makes the like price of not staying in lockstep very high. You're crazy if you don't keep up with the arbitrary standard that isn't about you. You know, you are, not us.
And one.
I think it's really interesting because it's just so, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't you semi-arbitrarily maintain a standard that everyone else is keeping at the same exact pace? You know, and like, to me, I'm like, All right.
It's again, it's that contradiction and that those things that are hard to discern as Americans, for one thing, and that they're almost surreal. If you can step back as you do in your book and look at them through new eyes, you say, wait a minute, why am I not wearing bell bottoms if I still fit in my bell bottoms from whatever year?
It's so funny. Why? You can even see it's so funny because it's like for famous people, like whoever you want to put, they're allowed to go a little bit further outside the lockstep of everybody else. Not too far, because then they just bat. But like, you bedazzle your blazer, because you're a famous person. You know, look at you. You're iconic because you're Lady Gaga doing whatever random thing. And we all know the person, especially like when you're younger, who did exactly what they wanted to do all the time, and they got made fun of or beat up for it, actually. Mm-hmm. They did that. And then they got socialized to not, because they wanted to be successful and, like, not hurt. So, to me, I'm just really interested in those kind of systems that are just kind of like, yeah, of course, why wouldn't you? And it's like, I think it's actually, like, maybe very insidious.
And I think in the book, clothing is this great, I mean, there's a lot of imagery that is a great substitute for our bodies and physicality, and the sense that there are things that we can't change, and it makes you examine the importance of appearance.
Though, I do also appreciate people choosing to look nice in whatever that means for them. And also, you know, for me, the original title would have been How to Sell a Jacket, actually. And I really did want a jacket for my mom, and I really did want that to be like an important thing. And I'm not saying there isn't some beauty in giving things. Mm-hmm. I just think that there's a problem when things are more important than humans.
There's a big problem. Well, we only have a few minutes left with Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, author of Friday Black. What I'd love to do to kind of close out the show is ask you if you're writing anything great that you want to tell us about, and maybe even more importantly, what are you reading right now, and what could you recommend to listeners in our last few minutes?
Am I writing anything great? Who knows? No, I'm trying to do something, but that's not that important. The Fruit of the Drunken Tree by Ingrid Rojas Contreras, I think, is a beautiful book. What else am I reading right now? I've been talking about There a lot by Tommy Olmertz, which I think is a beautiful book.
Getting a lot of attention this year, for sure.
Yeah. Great guy. Who else? There's like a lot of people that are on my mind.
Do you
like
read
to mention
fiction mostly?
Yes, I do mostly read fiction. I am about to read Heavy by Kisei Laman.
That looks good.
I have that, and that is not fiction. And also, is it Nicole Chung's book, All You Can Ever Know, as well. So I guess I'm also reading a little bit more than fiction at this point. Mm-hmm. But mostly I read fiction, yes.
Yeah. So to sort of finish out, I do think we have another minute. Do you want to tell us what you're writing now? Or are you not ready to talk about it?
I'm writing a novel codenamed Top Secret Novel.
Okay. Great. Top Secret Novel. We'll look for it in an appropriate amount of time that it takes one to write a novel.
Right.
Right. That sounds perfect. Well, it's been so nice to get to know you this hour on the Living Writers Show. Nana, I'm glad to know about your background and about your book of short stories, Friday Black, and I wish you all the best with it. We're going to close out the show with one more song that you've chosen for us, and we thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I do appreciate that.
Of course. Strange fruit hanging, strange fruit hanging, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree. Strange fruit hanging, strange fruit hanging. Shorty told me that she do not do the fakes. Same got weed. Mow the lawn, there's too many snakes. That's the same that got E. What, you ain't never seen a on a horse? You ain't seen Chief keep new Porsche? Nah, you ain't seen shit. Better not forget that. Spit it like I chain smoke new Porsche. All the little got guns now, and they carry them to the beat. All these little girls give it up now. Shame, I could see the cherry stems in the street. And
hang too high to lead the lows. Just hang too high to see the lows.
Ain't really listening. Let me break it down for you.
Just before you forgot about him, overlooked the started doubting. I doused it with the flow and started talking all this water. Just like I started drowning in truth. The thought is pounding. I started counting the loopholes and the stories that they tell us every evening at like 10 when Judy Sue was on your TV telling songs in the key of life. You was on your Stevie. I pray it's never too preachy, but I'm preaching, losing hella blood. These bleaching while you reaching. I'm like 6'5, stop it. We are not on the same plateau. Chateau de Chernay shoe, you just throwing shade in my shadow. Ginger ale in my chalice. I never been champagne shallow. I never run from a battle. I